Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. In this hour, we're talking about the federal government's plan to lift protections for the gray wolf and efforts to lobby Congress for more money to protect and restore the Great Lakes. But up first, we hear from those who support and oppose plans to remove the gray wolf from the endangered species list in the lower 48 states. Wisconsin DNR large carnivore specialist Scott Walter talks about the proposal and what it would mean for Wisconsin.
The Fish and Wildlife Service intends to publish a rule that would delist wolves across the lower 48 states, but that rule itself will not delist wolves. It needs to be published for a fairly lengthy 60 to 90 day public comment period. And after that, the service will need to review and respond to comments. And at that point, the final rule would be published and wolves would be delisted. What it would mean for those of us here in Wisconsin is that management authority for wolves would return to the state, and the Wisconsin DNR would have management authority for wolves within our borders.
Do you feel that it would be appropriate that management would return to the state?
Well, you know, there's certainly no biological reason why wolves should remain on the endangered species list. I view it as a great success story of the Endangered Species Act that wolves have recovered across the upper Great Lakes states. Numbers now in both Minnesota, Michigan, as well as Wisconsin are well above federal recovery levels and above levels that are listed in state wolf management plans. So I think delisting is certainly biologically justified.
Well, what would you say to groups like the Humane Society who argue that it's nowhere near its historic range?
Well, you know, that's one angle on the question, but what I would say is here in the upper Great Lakes states, numbers justify delisting.
And why is that? Why would the state like to see management return and then be able to control that, whether it's just through management or a wolf hunt?
Well, we do see impacts from wolves in the state. There are farmers that experience livestock depredations at the hands of wolves. For example, there are pets, dogs that are occasionally killed by wolves. So delisting and resumption of state management authority for wolves would allow us to implement a full suite of management tools, including lethal control, to address those issues as they arise.
What is the current population of wolves? Are you still going off of the roughly 900 to 944 wolf population range?
Yeah, the 905 to 944 count, that was last winter's count, and we're currently engaged. We've got a number of volunteers and DNR staff that are right now conducting winter track counts to derive an estimate of wolf numbers for this year. But yeah, that was the most recent estimate, 905 to 944.
So do you get any sense that the wolf population might be leveling off, or where do you think it stands right now?
Well, it's interesting. That count we just suggested, last winter's midwinter count, was the first time that wolves were on the federal endangered species list that the number dropped. So it may be, it only dropped by a little bit, about 2%, but it may be an indication that the wolf population is indeed leveling off in the state.
Okay. And what would this mean then? Like you said that there's a public comment period that has to happen. After that point, how quickly could the wolf be delisted if everyone approves of that?
Well, you know, if you just kind of count days on the calendar with a 60 to 90 day public comment period and then some period of time required for Fish and Wildlife Service staff to review all those comments and respond to them, I would think that we're certainly not likely to see actual wolf delisting until June at the very earliest.
June of this year?
Yes.
Okay.
And that's assuming that there aren't legal challenges to this rule that might not bind things up and delay or prevent delisting through court action.
Well, is there anything else that the DNR would have to prepare for? You know what? I'm just thinking about the management goals that have been set in the past. Have those been updated?
Well, when wolves were relisted in 2014, we were right near the end of a process that would have revised our state wolf management plan, including potential updates and revisions to the population goals. But when wolves were relisted and placed back on the endangered species list, that process was not completed. So we still have a wolf management plan guiding our actions in the state, but the revision, once wolves are delisted again, the revision of that plan will be completed. And we may have some different ideas about not just how many wolves we want in the state, but where we want those wolves to exist.
Douglas County Board Chairman Mark Liebert is among those who would like to see the state have more control over Wisconsin's wolf population.
It's overdue, I should say, and the reality of the wolf is the wolf is not endangered anymore, and there's lots of money being spent on the wolf as a species that when they're calling it endangered. So the fact that they remove this, I think, is not only a benefit for the people who need the wolves to be managed and controlled in numbers, and you know, predators need to be removed from the livestock industry, and it also then, I think, allows that money to be redirected towards species like the wood turtle and maybe the other species that are endangered and need to be protected, and the money has been lacking and being spent on the wolf, which is by every measurement recovered in the Great Lakes area for sure. And we've far exceeded the requirements of the Endangered Species Act as far as the numbers that needed to be there before they would be delisted. So this is common sense, I think, and it's a success for the management of the Endangered Species Act. It shows that under that law, under that act, that when the species are managed and protected, they can recover. And when they recover, they need to be removed so that those efforts to recover species can be directed at a species that needs to be recovered. I guess that's the easiest way to say it. It also allows the management of the state to control the numbers and to control where those wolves live, so that we don't have the predation that we do in the state of Wisconsin, either on dogs and pets, but, of course, livestock is my main concern.
Right, because you're a farmer.
Yep.
How many cattle do you have? Or tell me about your operation again.
Well, and remember, a livestock operation that feeds their cattle on concrete and has a big boarded fence around them doesn't have a wolf problem. In northern Wisconsin, most of the operations are grass-based. They need pasture in their system to succeed and hold their costs down. And an operation like mine, which is a grass-finished beef operation, relies on pasture for the biggest part of their diet to finish those animals out, to grow and finish those animals out. And when cattle are out on pasture and there's wolves that know how to kill them, they're under danger their entire time that they're out there. And when cattle are under stress, they don't get bred. When cattle are being chased by wolves, they don't eat. When cattle are being chased by wolves, their babies die. And it makes it harder for a livestock operation to be handled and managed the way most people, if they're looking at it environmentally, want their meat to come from a grass-finished type operation, rather than a feedlot. It's a quality of life for the animals, a quality of life for the farmer, and it's an environmental success, I think, when we were able to manage the livestock with grass as the cover over it. So those are the farmers that were most endangered under the wolf non-management, I think. And so they'll be, if this passes, and of course I've been under this a lot of times that we hear that there's a chance that it'll happen, so I'm optimistic anyway that hopefully this will happen and the farmers will have some relief and the Endangered Species Act will act like it's supposed to. It will shift the money to where it needs to be. So it's a win-win situation. I think it's a win for the environmentalists, it's a win for the livestock producers, and for sure it's a win for the sportsmen of the state also, because there'll be another opportunity to have an animal that's been recovered, like the turkeys and like we're trying to do with elk. And when they're recovered enough, And there's a hunting season on it. There's income that comes in. There's an opportunity for sportsmen. And the wolf will become a trophy rather than everybody disliking him, at least from the livestock industry anyway.
And you've lost some cattle too, right?
Yep, we've lost cattle.
How many cattle have you lost to?
Well, how many cattle that the state thinks we've lost to wolves and how many we think is sometimes a different number. We kind of, the way we run our cattle, we thought for a while we were immune from the wolves, and then we got hit real hard one year and we lost four. And we lost one last year that we were not able to verify that was killed by a wolf. And you end up adjusting your management to try to prevent that from happening. Most of the time it's costly. Animals that calve on pasture are almost guaranteed to thrive, but animals now that are calving out on pasture, most of them will probably be killed by the wolves in a lot of situations. Some of our ranchers in Douglas County have lost as many as 20, 25 calves a year. You know, and that's a big, you know, 10 to 20% of your calf crop that goes to wolves isn't a way to do business.
Melissa Tedrow recognizes wolves have an impact on farmers and their livestock, but the Midwest Region Director for the Humane Society of the United States opposes plans to remove protections for the wolf.
If the rule does go through, what it will mean in Wisconsin is that there will be a wolf hunt because we have a law, Act 169, passed in 2011 and enacted in 2012, that says that if wolves are not under ESA protections, there will be a wolf hunt in Wisconsin, and they will be hunted using some of the most egregiously cruel methods that we see in the country.
And that's basically why you're against the wolf hunt, because you feel like it's cruel to animals? Or, I guess, can you outline your reservations about the wolf hunt in Wisconsin?
So we are opposed to the delisting of wolves in general because they have not recovered to their full historic range. They are still missing or imperiled in many important portions of that range in the lower 48, and delisting them would cause their population to plummet. We saw that in Wisconsin, where after just a handful of hunting seasons, Wisconsin's wolf population dropped a full 20%. So we believe wolves still need these protections. While we will continue to fight for them, we do not think that states are responsible managers of wolves, and experience has shown that. So we'll be in this fight for the long haul.
Okay. Does that mean that you'll be seeking a legal challenge then, or...?
At this point, we are doing everything we can to make sure that wolves remain protected, and including what we'll do is ask the public to submit comments that oppose the Fish and Wildlife Service's proposal as soon as the comment period opens, which we would expect in the next few weeks here. And from there, we will weigh our options.
You know, one of the things I was talking to some people who were hailing this decision today, including State Senator Tom Tiffany, and
sure.
One of the things that he said is that, you know, if you restore wolves to their historic range, that would mean all throughout Wisconsin. And do wolf advocates want to see wolves in major urban areas like Madison and Milwaukee?
So that won't happen because wolves are deeply afraid of humans. They don't come near us. They stay far away from us. So there is absolutely no reason to expect that we're going to see wolves in urban areas anytime soon. They like to keep to themselves. They're very shy and private. As I said, they're afraid of people. So that is a claim that I've heard many times from Senator Tiffany and from others, and it's utterly false fear-mongering.
So is there a number or is there a point where you feel like the wolf will be restored?
So that is up to the best available science to determine. And right now, what scientists are saying all across the country is that we're not there. We, you know, the wolves are still in recovery. They need to retain protections. And so that's what we are keeping our eye on right now.
If the delisting were successful and Wisconsin were to return to a wolf hunt, what would you like to see in that instance?
So we would like to see a more democratic and open process where all members of the public, including wildlife watchers and people who enjoy seeing wolves alive, which is actually the majority of Wisconsinites, want to see wolves protected and not hunted, we would like to see those people have a seat at the table and to be able to weigh in on things like, management numbers and also methods. I mean, as I said, we have some of the most egregiously cruel methods for hunting wolves in the entire country, including leg-hold traps, hunting with dogs. It's really quite a terrible situation. So we're going to be sticking with this issue every step of the way, no matter what happens, and we just won't turn our back on it.
I know that you're opposed to delisting the wolf because it's not restored, but would you feel better about it if Wisconsin didn't use leg-hold traps or didn't hunt with dogs?
Sure. Well, so we absolutely have been in conversation about this for a long time. And, I mean, the short answer is yes, we don't want to see wolves hunted at all. If they are going to be hunted, we want to see the most egregiously cruel methods removed. I mean, we are opposed to the trophy hunting of wolves, period. And as an organization, we are opposed to the most egregiously cruel, inhumane, and unsporting methods of hunting that are out there. So those are the bases from which we move into the conversation, and you can expect us to be consistent on that moving forward with wolves.
Well, what would you say to, for example, farmers who have said, wolves have killed my livestock or it's really mm-hmm. interfered with my livelihood, we should be able to control problem wolves?
Sure. So I would say two things. One, there are a wide variety of non-lethal methods available that are shown to be highly effective. That's number one. Number two, studies have definitively shown that 9 times more livestock die from disease and weather and birthing problems and theft and other maladies than from all other predators combined, including wolves. So we're talking a minuscule number of depredations due to wolves. So really the problem is greatly exaggerated. Farmers should have the ability to protect their livestock, but they do using a whole suite of non-lethal methods that are very effective.
Wildlife biologist Peter David with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission says tribes are concerned about removing the wolf from the endangered species list.
A great deal of historic range still has not been reoccupied by wolves. And it's really important to protect the places where wolves have recovered, those small pockets, so that they can serve as seed sources to areas that have not yet recovered.
So when you talk about areas that have recovered, I mean, I'm assuming that you're saying that you don't believe that the wolf population has recovered in Wisconsin.
In Wisconsin, in the northern part of Wisconsin, where wolf densities are pretty high, I think a biological argument could be made that recovery has occurred. But historically, Wisconsin was wolf habitat, from north, south, east to west, and a lot of those areas haven't recovered. And some of those areas have somewhat limited suitability for certain right now, but there's large parts of the United States, when you look at it at that scale, and that's what this proposal delisting, as I understand it, is the scale that it's working on. There's large areas of suitable habitat that have yet to be recovered.
Like what areas would you give as an example, I guess?
Well, certainly the Northeast has areas, the Southern Rockies, some parts of Oregon and California, all have a lot of wolf suitability. And wolves are starting to make inroads into a couple of those areas. They really haven't yet in others. And to suggest that wolf recovery has taken place across the continent just really isn't supported by the populations that have come back in a few select areas.
I know that the wolf is culturally significant to tribes in Wisconsin. What would it mean if management returned back to the states and we saw a wolf hunt for tribes?
This hunting, that as it took place in the past, it really ultimately promotes sort of a trophy wolf harvest mentality, and that's really diametrically opposed to tribal cultural beliefs. I think that the management in Wisconsin, in particular in this region, it really devaluates the cultural and ecological significance of wolves, I think, to many non-tribal members as well. And Wisconsin right now is still sort of saddled by a very outdated and inappropriate population goal that goes back to a 1999 management plan. We have learned a lot about wolves since then, and we know a lot more about their ability to survive on the landscape here. And biologists are in very strong agreement that that population goal is inappropriate and needs to be significantly raised. But as long as that's on the books, there's the potential to significantly reduce the wolf population here, and that has both great cultural and ecological negative impacts that aren't really being fully addressed here in the state.
So is there a wolf population threshold that you think would be suitable or appropriate under state management?
We know that ecologically, wolves are very good at limiting their own numbers. And in fact, the evidence is that population in Minnesota has stopped growing, and Michigan it has largely stopped growing, and Wisconsin it appears to be likely on the cusp of stopping growing. So we don't need to harvest wolves to reduce their numbers or to keep their numbers under control. They do that extremely well at really very low, very modest numbers compared to other species. So there's not a profound need at all to harvest wolves. At the very least, from a harvest management perspective, the usual approach for species that are harvested is to not reduce the population to less than 3/4 of their carrying capacity. The existing Wisconsin population goal is significantly lower than that, and it really would place the wolf population back at a level that is easily susceptible to overharvest, and we could drive wolves back into those very low levels that took them a long time to recover from. So from a purely biological perspective, I think you'd be talking about at least doubling the wolf population goal in the state, and culturally there's no even real need to do that. People are much better at surviving and coexisting with wolves, I think, oftentimes than we give them credit for. And we have seen this population stabilize. It's not causing devastation across the landscape. I think there's much more sophisticated ways, perhaps, of working with wolves than is likely to unfold by this general delisting proposal.
And how do you feel that tribes, or how do tribes feel about how they've been included in past discussions related to delisting the wolf or lifting protections for the wolf?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I think, you know, the Fish and Wildlife Service tends to talk about handing over management authority to the state and the tribes. But in the past windows when wolves have been delisted in this region, I think we saw that the tribes' off-reservation rights in particular were largely disregarded by the states, and that's a big issue, that isn't recognized. I should also point out to the Fish and Wildlife Service that their responsibility to the tribes doesn't end with a delisting proposal, and yet in the past, again, there seemed to have been sort of a desire to wash their hands of wolves, if you will, once delisting occurred, and even though their responsibility to the tribes continues at that time.
Where do you feel like things stood the last time the U.S. government proposed delisting this? How did that process play out in the region?
You know, they were, instead of a national delisting, they had defined these regional population, distinct population units. And if you look even at the one here in the Western Great Lakes, and it was a significantly large area. And we talk about political gerrymandering a lot, but I think that proposal was an example of biological gerrymandering. At least 2/3 to 3/4 of the area that was delisted in that process included areas that were essentially wolfless. The entire Lower Peninsula of Michigan, for example, was delisted despite the fact there wasn't a single wolf in it. I think this takes that bad example and really expands it to an even larger area.
That was Peter David, a wildlife biologist with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, and we've been talking about the federal government's plan to lift protections for the gray wolf. The public will have an opportunity to weigh in on the proposal, which is likely to face a legal challenge. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll talk about efforts to bring more federal money to the region for restoring and protecting the Great Lakes. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Up next, we hear about efforts to lobby Congress for more funding to protect and restore the Great Lakes. Chad Lord is the policy director of the Healing Our Waters Coalition. He spoke with me about this week's annual event, Great Lakes Day, what it is, and the priorities they're hoping Congress will fund in the next fiscal year.
Great Lakes Day has been going on for over 10 years. We have been bringing in folks from the Great Lakes region, all of the eight Great Lakes states, for over a decade to be able to share stories with their members of Congress about the results we're seeing because of the investments being made in the region.
And who are all the organizations or individuals that take part in this event?
Oh, that's a very good question. This year we have over 100 people here in Washington who are visiting their members of Congress, again, to talk about the results that we're seeing because of the investments through the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, talking about the need to invest in our stormwater, wastewater, and drinking water infrastructure, talking about the need to stop Asian carp from getting into the Great Lakes. You know, these are folks that come from all over. We've got groups from Chicago. We have folks from up in Duluth, Minnesota here this week. We have people from Milwaukee and Green Bay. We have folks from Ohio and New York and Michigan. So we have people that are here who have been doing work on the ground, folks that have been doing projects with Great Lakes Restoration Initiative funds and other restoration dollars to really improve the water quality and habitat and invasive species work throughout the basin.
So what are some of the tangible results that you've seen as a result of the congressional funding that has been passed down for some of these projects?
That's a great question, and there are a lot of results that we can point to. I think some of the most exciting ones that are most tangible and are the cleanup that we're doing in the areas of concern around the region in northern Wisconsin, the St. Louis area of concern, which is a toxic hotspot that's shared between Superior, Wisconsin, and Duluth, Minnesota, has been seeing a ton of work in cleaning up those toxic sediments in both of those cities. And the results of that are that we're seeing, you know, wildlife and other animals that are coming back. We're seeing economic development in communities where we've been investing in those cleanup funds, in those cleanups. Sheboygan, Wisconsin is another example of where we've seen housing developments that are coming back because they've cleaned up that area of concern. But not only are those toxic hotspots being restored or cleaned up, we're also seeing the fact that we're moving barriers and rivers. Up to 5,000 miles of rivers have now been cleared of barriers, and so we're seeing fish and other wildlife that are reappearing in places that have, where they've been absent. So we're seeing this across the basin, all the way from Duluth, Minnesota, all the way to Lake Ontario, and it's very, very exciting.
And do you attribute that to the roughly $300 million through the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative?
We absolutely attribute it to the investments being made by Congress through the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. Had it not been for those resources on a consistent year-by-year basis, we would not be seeing the kinds of results in restoring and protecting this drinking water source for 30 million Americans that we're seeing right now.
Right, because a lot of these hotspots that you've referenced, like the St. Louis River area of concern, they had actually been identified, what, like 30 years ago or 40 years ago now?
Correct. They were identified in 1987 through a binational kind of negotiation between Canada and the United States, and they were not cleaned up for that entire period of time. And now, because of the investments that are being made, because of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, we are seeing work actually get done. I mean, it's really, really quite extraordinary that we now have, under the GLRI, delisted three of those areas of concern. We have seen eight other areas of concern have all the management actions that they needed to take to get them delisted have been completed, and now we're just waiting to see kind of how the environment responds. And, you know, we've seen, you know, the criteria that people use for those areas of concern, they're called beneficial use impairments, but, you know, they're important because they're the things that we judge, you know, whether or not those are the things that we use to judge the character of those toxic sites. And, you know, we've seen a six-fold increase in the number of those beneficial use impairments. Those criteria being cleaned up and taken off the list. And so none of that would have happened without the consistent investment by the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative.
Well, and I know that you're looking for that same level of steady investment, that $300 million for the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative in the next fiscal year. What would you like to see, if that is approved by Congress as it has been in the past, what would you like to see that put towards, or, you know, how do you see those funds being used for in the future?
We very much would like to see the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative continue to do the work that it has been doing for the past couple of years by investing in those area of concern cleanups. We also want to see the money is going towards helping stop agricultural runoff that's feeding harmful algal blooms across the basin. We also would like to continue to see investments being made to help control invasive species. The GLRI also funds important wetland restoration projects and habitat restoration projects, and we also want to continue to be focusing on those as well, because we know that those are the kinds of projects that also help drive our outdoor recreation economy throughout the region.
Well, and you mentioned cleaning up some of the agricultural runoff, and I just wanted to kind of focus on that, because water quality has been something that has been an increasing area of concern across the Great Lakes, whether it's related to agricultural runoff or other factors like contaminants like PFAS or these perfluoral. Oh, I can't remember the actual name for it.
PFAS, right,
right. Yeah. And, you know, what do you see as some of the biggest priorities for addressing issues with our drinking water and wastewater infrastructure around the lakes?
Well, what we're asking for Congress to do is to triple the funding for the state revolving funds, which go towards communities in the form of loans, in order that there is additional resources and funding available to communities in order to upgrade their wastewater systems or take action to remove lead pipes or other things that are causing water drinking water quality problems in communities. The reason why we're so focused on this funding is because, as you know, we've seen in recent reports over the last couple of weeks, water rates that homeowners have to pay are going up, and many, many people are becoming just can't afford to kind of continue to pay those water rate increases. And we really do need that federal partnership to help our communities address, you know, an issue that is still causing too many families not to have access to safe, affordable water.
And I know this was also an issue that you addressed last year, correct?
We have been talking about investments in stormwater, wastewater, and drinking water infrastructure for the last couple of years.
I guess, so you're asking for $179 billion, is that right?
No, the $179 billion is what the region needs to fix its aging infrastructure. That is the overall deferred maintenance costs that have been documented by the Environmental Protection Agency. I can say that that number is actually probably low. What we've seen through talking to some partners, for example, in New York, is that those numbers are probably don't reflect, the full need. And so that number is probably actually quite higher. But what we're using is statistics that have been assembled by the U.S. EPA. And what we know right now is that there's $180 billion worth of need in the Great Lakes states to improve their wastewater and drinking water.
And, you know, I imagine that these projects just become more costly as time goes on.
That's absolutely correct. It doesn't get any cheaper to fix these. And as the infrastructure ages, it becomes even more expensive to do the work to get them back up to code.
Well, and another issue that you were lobbying for at the Capitol this week was protecting the Great Lakes from Asian carp and other invasive species. You know, there's been a lot of debate over funding for that, and it's been kind of contingent on a plan coming out, I believe, from, what was it, the Army Corps of Engineers?
That's correct.
So where are we at with the discussion over controlling the spread of Asian carp in keeping that out of Lake Michigan?
Where we're at right now is that the Army Corps of Engineers has closed the period in which the public can comment on its tentatively selected plan at creating a choke point at the Brandon Road Lock and Dam in Illinois. They will have to now process all the comments that they receive and provide a final plan sometime in the next couple of months. Once that final plan is finalized, then we will have they will have to move to kind of developing the blueprints that will allow them to construct the plan. And so right now what we're doing in Congress is to ask them to ensure that the Army Corps of Engineers has the resources they need in order to create the engineering and the design that are necessary to move towards construction. But the other kind of quirky thing is that not only does the Army Corps need the money, Congress also then needs to authorize the construction of the work there. And so we're also just asking Congress to make sure that this project stays on track because of the fact that Asian carp could devastate the $7 billion fishery in the Great Lakes. And in order to do that, they need to authorize the construction of the new work at the Brandon Road Lock and Dam as quickly as possible.
And what was it? Was it last summer or the summer before that where an Asian carp was found within, 9 miles from Lake Michigan?
Yeah, there's been some of that that we've seen pop up over the last couple of years. And I think it just underscores the urgency for decision makers, whether or not they're the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in the administration or whether or not it's Congress. But for all of us, whether or not it's federal, state, or local, to continue to focus on this issue because it is such an urgent priority. If the Asian carp were to get in Lake Michigan, it really would could very well devastate the Great Lakes ecosystem
and the entire economy that relies on the Great Lakes.
That's absolutely correct. I mean, the Great Lakes are, you know, a huge driver for outdoor recreation economy with boating and fishing and other just wildlife watching and other recreation, paddling, canoeing, the rest of it. We've seen some of the damage these fish have done in the Illinois River and some of the other river systems, and we just do not want to repeat that anywhere in the Great Lakes Basin.
Well, and we kind of touched on it before, but I also understand you're lobbying to support conservation programs in the new Farm Bill as part of priorities for the Great Lakes.
We definitely talked about that last year because Farm Bill conservation programs are so important when we talk about helping farmers control the nutrients in their soil. Those nutrients, when they wash off into the waters, are what feeds these harmful and toxic algae blooms. And so we really want the farmers to have the resources they need in order to do the conservation practices on their lands in order to help, in order to contribute to everybody's goal, which is to reduce that agricultural runoff, which is causing these algae blooms all over the region. And so we talked to Congress last year, and thankfully they passed a farm bill last year, one that has a lot of good investments in it. You know, and I think the folks from the Wisconsin delegation, Senator Baldwin, Michigan, with the leadership of Senator Stabenow, really pushed forward with supporting those conservation programs through the Farm Bill in order to address water quality issues across the basin. And so we are reminding members of Congress that it is important that they continue to prioritize support for those programs, because along with the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, in combination, they actually do a ton of work to help the region's farmers help protect our water.
Well, and thinking about the region's farmers, you know, it's been a really tough year for them with, you know, at least for dairy farmers, with milk prices being down, and also for farmers in general with the changing markets related to trade. Is there any concern that, you know, they may be so focused on trying to maintain their livelihood right now that you might see less buy-in to implement some of these practices that would reduce impacts to water quality because it would be costly for them to do that?
Yeah, I don't have an answer to that question. Actually, I think farmers do the best they can under the circumstances, and what we want to try and do is provide them with, with all the options that will help it make it easy for them to undertake conservation practices that we know will help reduce the runoff from their farm fields into the waters. You know, we want to be helpful, and we want to support everything we can to make it easy for agriculture to make these decisions.
So as part of that, would some of these conservation practices or programs that would be put in place, would that provide financial assistance for farmers?
Yes, some of the Farm Bill conservation programs would provide assistance to farmers that so they can take action.
Okay. Well, and I guess, you know, just kind of taking a look at the big picture of, you know, there are a lot of competing priorities for congressional funding. You know, I think the president said in his State of the Union that he wanted to address rising healthcare costs and prescription drug prices and also make investments in infrastructure. So how do you see, you know, the priorities for the Great Lakes stacking up against other national priorities?
Yeah, we just don't see them as being in competition, because the work that we're trying to do in the region by improving, restoring, and protecting the Great Lakes is not just an environmental story, but it's also a health and it's a health story. It's a public. It's an economic story. We know that investments through the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, for example, has a 3-to-1 return on investment. We know that the work that we're doing through those investments in communities is resulting in new business activity and new home building. We see how it supports, you know, the outdoor recreation economy, which is, you know, billions of dollars into our region, either through angling or hunting or wildlife watching or boating. And so we don't see it as an either or. We see it as an investment in the region's future, and one that helps really address a lot of the different issues that people are facing.
Well, I really appreciate you taking time to speak with me about all the priorities that you're seeking for funding under the next budget. Is there anything else that I'm missing that you would like to add?
Yeah, the only thing I would add is I hope people are excited about the results we're seeing because of the investments. You know, I hope people remember that even though we've done a lot of work under the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, we still have a lot of work to do, and we would just ask that everyone join us in pushing their members of Congress and the other decision makers to continue to invest in the Great Lakes, because when we do, we see good things.
Again, you were just listening to Chad Lord, Policy Director with the Healing Our Waters Coalition. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll hear from Steve Fisher with the American Great Lakes Ports Association about their top priorities for federal funding. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Before the break, we heard from Chad Lord with the Healing Our Waters Coalition about efforts to bring federal money to the Great Lakes for environmental restoration. Up next, we hear about priorities for funding navigation projects on the lakes. Steve Fisher is the Executive Director with the American Great Lakes Ports Association.
In the navigation system on the Great Lakes, we have a number of federal priorities. Top among them is funding the construction of a new navigation lock at Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. This is in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. There is existing navigation locks there right at this time, and they are growing old, and the Army Corps of Engineers, who manages this facility, has developed a program to construct a brand new lock at that location. The Congress has authorized that project in legislation just last year during 2018, and now the challenge is to fund that project. It'll take about 10 years to construct the project. It's a very big construction project, roughly $1 billion in cost, and so it will take the collective inertia of all our Great Lakes legislators to try to convince Congress to prioritize funding for this project among many projects around the United States, but to prioritize this investment in our region.
Well, and how important is that? I mean, you said that, you know, they're growing old, or the locks are aging. So what kind of impact could that have if the locks were to shut down?
Sure. The locks are critical for America's steel industry. The majority of U.S. steelmaking occurs on the Great Lakes in Great Lakes cities. And the iron ore that supplies those steel mills largely comes from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and from Minnesota. That iron ore supply is loaded onto very large lake freighters on Lake Superior, taken through the locks, and then delivered to southern Great Lakes ports in Ohio, Michigan, and Indiana, where the steel mills are located. That steelmaking is critical to the auto industry, which is also largely centered in our region, and appliance and industrial product manufacturers. So the trickle effect is considerable. If those locks were to fail and those freighters filled with iron ore were not able to deliver or keep the supply chain going to the steel industry, it would have a huge ripple effect in the economy.
And I know this is also a project that you've been advocating for a very long time, right?
The maritime industry has been working on this project for decades, almost 30 years now. The project was first authorized by Congress in 1986, just to give you a sense of how long this project has been in the works. It was reauthorized by Congress last year, and the authorization was updated, meaning that the cost estimate for the project was updated. This project has been underway, being worked on in one regard or another for over 30 years.
Well, considering that it was first authorized in 1986, as you said, what kind of hope do you have that this will actually receive funding in the near future if they've kicked the can this far down the road?
So the most significant thing that happened on this project is that last year Congress provided an appropriation for the very first year of construction funds. And typically, Congress won't do that for a large construction project, a large federal construction project like this anywhere in the country, unless they intend to follow through. It makes no fiscal sense to fund the first year of a 10-year project if, in fact, you're not going to fund the subsequent years. So the important signal we've gotten from Congress is that they are prepared to begin the long road of funding this project. That's significant. That's why we're hopeful.
And as you said, it would be a 10-year project, about $1 billion.
Correct.
What's the next step then?
Well, the next step is to secure the second year funding, and we're going to have to all work on this year after year. Congress only funds projects in an annual way, which makes it a bit cumbersome, but nevertheless, it's the way they do it. And so each year we will have to go to Capitol Hill and make the case to our legislators to secure the next chunk of money for the next year of construction. So this is going to be a 10-year effort, but definitely worthwhile. Again, we have the first year under our belt, so that part's done. Now we're going to work on the second year. Funding, by the way, for the second year, the needed amount is $69 million to fully fund the second year. I want to note that the state of Michigan has put up some funds itself, from its own state budget to help fund the project, so that's helping as well.
Well, and were there other priorities that you were pushing for, or that you're pushing for this year related to navigation infrastructure or harbors and ports around the lakes?
Absolutely. There are a number of other priorities with regard to the Great Lakes navigation system. For example, there is currently a $160 million backlog of harbor and channel dredging that needs to be done in Great Lakes ports. These are the underwater channels that allow the port to be deep enough for the large ships to come in and out of the port. Those channels are maintained by the Army Corps of Engineers. Mother Nature simply moves sand around during storms and so on, so that sand has to be removed from time to time from these underwater shipping channels to allow the harbor to be deep enough to keep, for the large ships to come in. So that work is funded by Congress also, and unfortunately, congressional funding has fallen behind, and we have this huge backlog in the Great Lakes of channel dredging that needs to be done, $160 million worth. So that investment needs to occur. Now we're making progress. 5 years ago, our backlog was $200 million. We've whittled it down to $160 million. So progress is being made, and we hope to continue that effort to whittle that backlog down. In addition, there is $320 million worth of repair work in the Great Lakes on breakwaters and jetties. These are the stone structures you often see off the shoreline in cities like Chicago or Cleveland or Milwaukee. Large piles of stone in a linear fashion out in the water that helps break up the big waves so they don't come in and smash up the port or the harbor or the lakefront in these various cities. So these structures were built long ago. Many of them are crumbling. Harsh winter weather often will damage them, and the Army Corps of Engineers needs to have appropriate funding to come in and repair these structures. But we have a backlog of $320 million of work that needs to be done throughout the Great Lakes on these structures.
And as you mentioned, harsh winter weather can have an impact, but we've also seen a lot more storms as a result of climate change. Is that contributing to the problem right now around the lakes?
Well, definitely the weather is impacting these structures. Every time there's a harsh storm on the Great Lakes, it has the potential to deteriorate these structures. So I think there's definitely an effect from climate change on these structures. I think it'd be hard to argue otherwise.
Well, what else would you like Congress to prioritize under the next budget, or what is your hope as things move forward?
There's one new item that I'd like to highlight. Last year, for the first time, Congress funded a port infrastructure grant program. Now, people probably assume the federal government's providing funding for ports around the country. That's not the case. It never has. Ports are largely locally funded as far as their actual infrastructure, usually funded by the local port agency or local city or county government, sometimes the state, but rarely the federal government. So the port itself, for example, the buildings, the cranes, the roadways and rail lines and so on within the port, that's all been paid for locally up till now. For the first time in history, last year Congress provided $293 million for the nation, but for a port infrastructure grant program that'll help a lot of our ports tackle their investment needs as far as modernizing their facilities. If you go to Great Lakes ports today, we still have some of the infrastructure from the 1930s and 1940s. A lot of that needs to be modernized, and so this new grant program will be a big help, and we're going to be urging Congress to fund it annually and hopefully provide the necessary funds.
Because right now a lot of those repairs depend upon private entities who own those structures?
Either private entities or quite often the ports will talk to the state government to see if they can secure grants from the state government. Sometimes the county government or the city government has to put up funds from their own budgets to repair the local port. Sometimes they'll do financing, but rarely has there been, never has there been federal funds for this purpose, I mean specifically for this purpose. So this is a new development that we're quite excited about.
So what would you say to folks who would question why taxpayers should pay for these improvements rather than the companies that own these properties?
Well, let me be specific. This new program is only eligible for public ports. So these are publicly owned port facilities. Any private port, and there's a lot of private ports in the Great Lakes, where company-owned ports, they are not eligible for these funds. So good point. They're not eligible for these funds, and these funds would not go to a private company. But where you have a public port, and I would compare it to a private airport versus a public airport, where you have a public port where there is a community benefit from the port, and it's run by the community. Most of our ports are run by either the city, the county, or the state government. Then there's a public benefit to the community by maintaining the port's infrastructure, and it's an economic benefit.
I appreciate you clarifying that note. I'm sorry I misunderstood you. Is there anything else at all that I'm missing, Steve, that you would like to add about Great Lakes Day at the nation's capital this week?
Well, don't forget that part of Great Lakes Day is not just the investments in the region's infrastructure, but also in cleaning up and restoring the region's environment. And, there's other groups who probably are better spokesmen on those aspects than we are, but I just want to stress that, from the perspective of Great Lakes ports, we're all public agencies. Our members are public agencies. And, the investments the federal government is making in the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative are critical. That program is funded at roughly $300 million a year, and those funds go into many, many diverse efforts throughout the region to try to restore habitat, to try to clean up contamination from, years and decades ago, and those efforts are equally important. The investments we're making in our economy, literally in the infrastructure and so on, and then the investments we're making in cleaning up the Great Lakes, all those do the same thing. They help stimulate the region. They help economically stimulate the region. There's a tremendous economic benefit from these investments being made by the federal government. So Great Lakes Day is all about shining a spotlight on those.
Again, you were just listening to Steve Fisher with the American Great Lakes Ports Association. You can hear an extended interview with him about Great Lakes navigation priorities on our website at wpr.org/superior. That's it for our program. We hope to have you back with us again next Friday. Until then, have a great weekend.